I wasn't sure whether you were teaching or not. Sorry?
Well, good evening, Ralph and Tracy. Welcome back. You survived your little experimental excursion. The main thing is, it's interesting, Tracy came back with Ralph. I thought they might have gotten a little, at odds with each other in cramped quarters, and she might have just driven that rig back by herself, but we're glad. We're glad you're both here. Thinking of them reminds us of Sister Arlene. Be sure to wish her well. Be sure to let her know of your love for her and missing her. We'll have to readjust to that. We're trying to readjust to Brother Billy's absence from us, but being with the Lord, as Paul called it here in Philippians, we're trying to adjust to that, and we'll miss Arlene likewise. We'll look at our questions here. We left off talking about questions 7 and 8. Basically, they go together negatively and positively. How we're to think if we're going to make this unity actually a reality. We just sang about loving one another, the Father's command, and Jesus. You might say the Father's passed on through Jesus. Jesus is the one who gave that command while on earth. It was referred to as what kind of command? What command? What kind? Well, we sang that. That's the phrase you're thinking, blessed, but... Fine. Yeah, Jesus called it...
A new commandment.
Remember that? A new commandment I give to you. Let's turn to that. One place I can always turn to is John 13, where Jesus had washed the disciples' feet. He showed that kind of love in action. And I remember the reference because of the threes in it. John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35. Who'll read that for us? Ralph, you have it, please.
Yeah. 13, 34, 35. Okay. Oh, Jerusalem.
Whoa, I'm sorry. I might have said something else.
You did. I just went to the wrong book.
Yeah. John 13, 34.
A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
So remember this basic commandment. And especially since Jesus says it is a sign of being a true disciple, a sign of it to the world. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you show this kind of love toward each other. And I say this kind of love. What's new about it? What's new about this commandment? It sure reminds me of another commandment. So I'll start with that. It should remind you of what commandment?
Love your neighbor as yourself.
Right. Love your neighbor as yourself. And how was that commandment described? Like this is described as new. Not every time it's mentioned, but by Jesus. How did he describe that commandment?
As part of the greatest commandment.
Yeah, but you're right. And he used a term to relate it to the greatest. So you have the greatest, and then he said this was what?
Second one.
Yeah. What? Excuse me?
Second one.
Second, yeah. And second to it, or a second commandment. Right. You were saying, Steve?
It sums up all the other commandments in it.
Well, yeah, it does. So both of those, the greatest sums up like the first four of the ten. And then loving your neighbor as yourself sums up five on all the relationships toward others. But yeah, the second greatest commandment, you might call it. The second greatest is love your neighbor as yourself. What's the difference between the second greatest and the new? And it's what's making it new. So here's love your neighbor as yourself. Here's love one another. Molly?
Instead of
Yes. So that's the qualifying and making it new. Again, that you love one another even as I have loved you. That's different than loving your neighbor as you love yourself. Which is huge. That's huge to love like that. To love others as much as you love yourself. Because we love ourselves a whole lot. And it'd be great to love others a whole lot. That's really doing a lot. And then this, even more. To love as Jesus loved. And so what about that kind of love is new and different? What about that kind or degree? How did Jesus love, Garrett?
Humbly.
Okay, very humbly. Yeah, and so to what degree did he show that? To die, yeah, to die as a self, to give himself in sacrifice. So that's easy to say and to state, you know, just from scriptures. But to actually practice it, to die for a brother or sister, to love someone that much. Who talked about not only Jesus, the fact that he died for all men, but who talked about us loving? He used the term love and actually being willing to die for your fellow brother or sister. Who actually made that application? Yes.
John.
Yeah. First John. And you remember which chapter that was? I think it's 3. Turn to First John. This little review. First John chapter 3. And Linda, please read verse 16. 17 and 18. And again, listen for this new commandment. And by the way, it's the same author, John, who wrote where we first read in John. He wrote the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verse 34, and called it a new commandment. The other Gospel writers don't call it that. And John in 1 John will talk about this same new commandment. Back in chapter 2 and 7, I'll glance at that first. Beloved, I'm not writing a new commandment to you, but an old one which you've had from the beginning. The beginning here is the beginning of the faith, the beginning of Christianity. John's writing in his older age, we presume like in the 90s. At least that's where we date his revelation. He's writing later on. And yet he's referring back to the beginning of this new movement, this new way, the way. And so he says, I'm not writing a new but an old. The old commandment is the word which you have heard. On the other hand, I am writing a new commandment to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. And he gets to the point in verse 10, the one who loves his brother abides in the light. But in chapter 3, Linda, please read.
We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth.
What's loving with word or with tongue? What's that?
Go in peace. Be well.
Right. Just saying it. Right. Just saying it. Don't just say you love. Or for that matter, don't just sing about loving one another. That's good. That's a start. But that can be just loving with deed or with the tongue. But rather, in word or in tongue, but rather in deed, in your doings. Love by what you do for your brother and sister in truth. And he was the one who said we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. That is challenging. And you might say with certain brethren, especially challenging to be willing to die for them. So I am saying, face that. Think about that on your own time, in your own quiet little space, in your own meditation. Would I do that? I should. So will I. And consider this. If you really can lay down your life for your brother, isn't that the greatest thing you have that you could give? If you could do that, then what could you more easily do that John mentioned?
Give your brother the things he needs.
Give any of your goods. So really, there's like no excuse if you're not doing that simpler thing. I find this brother or sister needs this. Here, I have one. Have it. Use it. And if we have a hard time doing that, don't kid yourself. You won't be laying down your life. And if you're not doing that, you're really not keeping the new commandment. Again, going back to Jesus' own words. That you love one another even as I have loved you. And then if you broaden that out, if you're going to love like Jesus loved, and again, that love is really defined. It's defined and even limited by all the teachings of Jesus. It doesn't just mean anything the world calls love. But when you're doing that, then it's going to involve even more, for example, more than just laying your life or giving your goods. All that's involved in working together, like a local congregation, everything that's involved in that, you're loving to that degree where we are willing to give, be patient, forbear, I'll state my judgment, I'll state my preference, but you all don't have to do it, is what each one would be saying. I'll state, again, what I think is maybe the best course or the better course to go, my judgment. I'll state my opinion. I'll state my color preference. My druthers, all of those things. There's a place to express that. And then, but I'm not going to make that, I'm not going to force that upon one another out of love. So come back here now. We'll come to Philippians. And right here in chapter 2, we were talking about the actual act of loving in bringing about this unity. Paul said, if there is any consolation, is one translation, any consolation of love. And then he said again, in actually applying, when he talked about applying those experiences, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love. It's just literally having the same love. So in practice, putting that in practice. Question 7 stated negatively how we go about working with each other. And that was, I'll read verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. We talked about that selfishness. It's the same term as back in chapter 1 and verse 17. I don't know why the very same translation, this NASB that we're all using, didn't use it this close to the first use of it. Selfish ambition, just to really emphasize what's driving, you see. What's driving a person when Paul says, do nothing from that, your own selfish ambition. Your desire to push, we'll say in modern terms, push your agenda. Your own desires and purposes. Do nothing from selfish ambition. A work of the flesh. This very same word, the Greek word, is found in Galatians chapter 5 and 20. A work of the flesh. Put it away from us. I will make one more comment on that term that we didn't look at before. Who's a prime example? Probably the classic example of selfish ambition in a New Testament church. Selfish ambition. That what was driving the person? That's what he acted on. Laura? Diotrephes, I'm thinking. So turn to 3 John where he's found, where John addresses him, not him directly, he's talking to Gaius, but about, warning him about Diotrephes. 3 John, Laura, read verses 9 and 10, and you'll see the selfish ambition in this brother.
I wrote something to the church, that Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. And not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forgives those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church.
So verse 10 describes his selfish ambition at work. Verse 10 describes that he has the selfish ambition, just in other terms. He loves to be first. An old translation said he loves to have the preeminence. He loves to have first place among the brethren. And because of that, here are his actions. Also in verse 9 at the end, the very last phrase, he does not accept what we say. Who's the we? Because, by the way, Diotrephes doesn't have to accept what I say. He doesn't have to say what I say. Or even what Matt and I say. That would be a we. So we, Matt and I, told Diotrephes something and he said, "Fooey on you, Tim and Matthew." Who's this we that he does not accept? Who? Ralph. Yeah. Like John himself. Right. That authority. And it comes from his, again, selfish ambition. He's not going to allow someone else, like an apostle, to tell him what he needs to think or believe or do. He's deciding all on his own. And so here's what else he does in verse 10. He falsely accuses the apostles, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. Not only that, in the middle of verse 10, what does he also refuse to do himself personally? He doesn't do what?
Receive the brethren.
Yeah, and what is that about in this little letter? What's that about? Receiving the brethren.
Maybe traveling brethren, maybe even traveling preachers.
Right, and so the receiving is doing what?
Well, being hospitable.
Right.
Supporting them on their journey.
Right, yeah. Actually housing them, welcoming them, giving them what they need, sending them on their way. So by the way, Gaius had been doing that. And that's what John referred to earlier. He's writing this letter on the very occasion of verse 3. "I was very glad when brethren came and bore witness to your truth, how you are walking in truth." And he goes on to explain. He doesn't just mean in truth in general, but that he's actually practicing this kind of needful hospitality. And it wasn't social hospitality, as good as that is to do today, really, as good as that is. Our culture today, we fail in that. We're all on our own, take care of our own needs so well, just stay in our homes, watch TV. Social hospitality is so important. But that's not what this is even talking about. This is practical hospitality, needful housing, clothing, bathing, feeding, supplying as they go on. And Gaius had just done that to some of these brethren, and now they come to John, and they're bearing witness to that. And so he commends Gaius for that, and that's probably why he brings up Diotrephes. He's probably going to, if not already, he's going to rub with this man. Because this man doesn't do what Gaius does. This Diotrephes will not receive the brethren. And he forbids those who desire to do so, like Gaius. He forbids them. And that's bad enough there. It's a separate step even after that. He doesn't do it, and he's telling the other brethren, "You can't do it either." Wow, that's selfish ambition practiced. And sadly, the brethren so far were not dealing with him. That's weakness on their part too, that they let him do this. Perhaps with John's help. John says, "If I come," hopefully with John's help, when he shows up, they can deal with this man. That's selfish ambition. And the greatest example, the last phrase, "and he puts them out of the church." Really, this one man can do that. A local, yeah. a local assembly. Who's telling who's accepted and who's not? Yeah. You just can't be a part of this congregation because you receive the brethren, at least for that. You do that. So, you're no longer welcome. And there are ways you can force someone out of a local congregation. Good question. And can I ask, why are you asking the question? Because there's another concept of church, isn't there?
Yes.
What about it, Garrett? What's that? And what about that?
I just don't know how one man puts somebody out of the body of
Christ. You know why you don't know how?
Because
they can't. Good point. You're right. You can't do that. Because who determines that? Who determines who's accepted in it and who's not?
Christ.
Yeah. God Himself does. And the Lord knows those who are His own. And by the way, Garrett, what about all these brethren that Diotrephes was putting out of a local church? What about them in this other meaning of church? Okay, these are good brethren because they're receiving traveling. They're receiving traveling brethren. He puts meaning that you can't meet with them anymore. You're not considered a part of the group. You're not welcome. But what about them still?
They're still part of the Lord's church.
They're still part of the Lord's church. That's right. Just because this one man doesn't accept them didn't change that at all. So, you see this actually at work and actually in practice. And sadly, to one degree or another, and over other matters, maybe not this matter of receiving traveling preaching brethren, but over other matters, you find Diotrephes in congregations today. And it's sad, and the Lord is going to judge. You know, we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, whoever destroys the temple of God, God will do what?
Destroy him.
And what's the temple that was being referred to in that verse? See, there's another temple of God that's spoken about in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and that's the temple of your body. And that's spelled out. The temple which is your body. But in chapter 3, well, let's turn to it. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. This is how you get some of these things down when you look right at it. So again, the end of chapter 6 is famous about talking about what sin? Flee what sin? Flee
sexual immorality.
Fornication. Flee sexual immorality. And that's the context of your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. But chapter 3 was the sin of them being babes, immature, being fleshly, being carnal, acting like mere men, divided. They were divided over men, over leaders. I am of Paul, verse 4. I am of Apollos. I am of Cephas. That was the context. And now, Steve, please read verses 16 and 17.
Do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him. The temple of God is holy, and that is what you are.
Yes. Now, we may not catch the actual reference to the temple because English is not as specific as the Greek was. We don't have a plural you and a singular you. Well, not in King's English. You do in Southern English. Ewens! Ewens is plural. You is singular. All that say, the you here is plural in the Greek. Do you not know that you all are a temple. So, you all, plural. A temple. And the Spirit of God dwells in you all. If any man destroys the temple, God will destroy him. And that is what you all are. Singular. And that fits the context, too. He's talking about that whole local congregation and their problems. And those problems amounted to, if continued in, they would destroy. They would destroy God's temple. And God says, I'm going to judge that. And God will judge that Diotrephes and those that are being similar in principle to Him. So back here in Philippians, do nothing. Any comments on this? Do nothing from selfish ambition. Brother Ken.
As I'm sure it's true with you, I've known several of these people over the years. And there's not that many of them compared to how many Christians there are.
Sure.
They sure do a lot of damage just for being so few.
And that is true, too. Yeah, just an observation, you know, from Ken's experience and knowing of working with different brethren also. It does do a lot of damage. You can see how that fits the language of destroying the temple of God.
They fall under stumbling blocks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we know what Jesus said about the stumbling block. We studied that rather recently. It'd be better if they were drowned, if that's all they were going to receive. It'd be better just to receive drowning for doing that to others. But instead, there's the judgment of hell, actually, for stumbling blocks. So, we're trying to apply this in working together in unity, do nothing from selfish ambition or empty conceit. No one actually admits that's what it is. If you actually said, I have empty conceit, well, you would give it up because you realize, whoa, it's vain. That's another word for empty. It's vain. It's useless. It is really not accomplishing good. And it's not even real. Meaning, conceit is your high view of yourself. That's not reality. You are not high. God views you and knows what you are compared to Him. So it is empty. It is vain. It is unreal, this conceited view of self. Do nothing out of that. But brethren have been tempted to, by all means. And for that matter, we can be tempted to, whether we actually act on it. But we can be tempted to. It is, I think, I know what's best to be done. You know, whether or not anyone's consulting me, I think I know. Not I think I know. This conceited view says, I know. I have the best view of this and the best solution. And then there are some that will actually, so I'm going to act on it. I'm going to force this way. And sometimes the forcing is subtle. They just start working. They just start working a plan beneath the surface. Maybe I'll go around to homes and plant my idea that's best. I'll just plant it home by home by home by home. And then just bring it up all in one assembly. See, isn't that what we're going to do? And everyone just goes along with that. And that has been practiced by brethren too. That kind of, we sometimes call it politicking, even among brethren. Do nothing from that. That's that negative side. On the other hand, with humility of mind, the humility directly corresponds to the conceited view. And the regard for others is the exact answer to selfish ambition, but regarding one another as more important than himself. So that's question 8 now. Also, positively, what view of self must each one develop? Humility of mind. And going with that, what view of others must each one develop regarding another as more important than himself? How easy is doing that? Regarding others as more important. How easy? Is anyone willing to give us the honest answer there? Bev? It's not. Is it impossible?
No.
No. But it takes work. It takes thinking about this, praying about this, searching yourself, especially when it comes to specific situations of different wills being expressed, and being honest with self about that. Regarding others as more important than himself. Now, this might help. This might help us to actually do this. It's not one of the questions, but are you told to view someone, or are you supposed to say and believe someone is more important than you? Are you to look at someone else and say, they are more important than I am? No, it doesn't say that. Because you'd soon have a contradiction. So, I'm looking at Ralph and I say, Ralph, you're more important than I am. Ralph's looking at me and saying, Tim, no, Tim, you're more important than I am. Wow. Well, now we've got it. We've caused God a dilemma. You're greater. No, I'm greater. I should have started the other way around so that you end up, right? So that you end up greater. Okay, I'm greater. No, you're greater. And God says, wow, what am I going to do? And that's just two of you guys, and you're all greater.
It's okay, because to be the least is to be the greatest.
So. Wait. Hey, you're right. You're getting ahead of the ball game there. Oh, boy. So my point was to illustrate, we're not to worry about actual greatness. Like in God's eyes. Who actually is greater? That's not the point. And it's not what's helping you with your attitude. There is relative greatness in the kingdom. There is relative greatness. Let God determine that. But when it actually comes to working together, like he says here, regard as more important. Regard as more important. You might say, who is actually important to a certain flock? Call that as a local body. Who is more important to the flock? The shepherds of it or the newborn sheep that's just come into it? And should the newborn sheep then, should that one be given, you might say, the freedom or liberty to decide everything that's done in that flock, and that's actually viewing them as more important? No, that is not God's wisdom, just to kind of illustrate that point. That newborn sheep is not actually more important to the flock than the shepherds. But when it comes to our actual working with each other, we are to regard as more important. And that means not that they're given the direction, but that you take the time to show care for them. You ask them what their needs are. What do you need to be a part of this flock? Or what are you having difficulty with? What are you struggling with? How can we help with that? And that's showing them or regarding them as more important than, for example, just looking to the mature sheep. And we just spend time with the mature sheep. We talk with them. We discuss things with them. And we ignore that newborn sheep. That's not regarding as more important. Yeah.
It makes me think of a very picturesque scene. And in that, when Jesus washed the disciples' feet.
Good. Thank you. Right. He was treating his disciples as more important than himself in that very setting. Instead of relaxing, just enjoying the meal and relaxing, no. He does this, puts forth this effort, does this very task at hand to wash their feet. And it's a good example because it didn't mean the disciples really were more important than Jesus. But he was regarding them as more important. So that very example helps us understand this. And what's interesting is, let me just jump ahead to some comments here. These we've gone to, but these. So this last point we have here. Regard one another as more important than self. There's a direct contrast with the 12 disciples. How do they regard one another? And I'll have to qualify during Jesus' earthly ministry, not from the book of Acts on, when they became different and got it, like we're to get it. How did they consider one another? And it's a direct contrast. Brother Steve?
Well, James and John wanted to be seated on Jesus' right and left
hand. Right. They considered themselves more important than the rest. Or Garrett, what were they always discussing more than once? What were they discussing among themselves, to use that wording? Who's the greatest? And according to Philippians 2, what answer should they have come to? So they have this great discussion more than once. Who's the greatest among us? And what would the answer have been? Should have been?
Everybody but me.
Right. Or they could just take turns. You are. You're the greatest. No, no, you are. No, no, you are. No, you are. No, you are. No, you are. 12 times. And they'd all be right. Now, that's just said for emphasis. But this is the exact opposite attitude. They were not thinking this way. Who is the greatest? And obviously their interest was each thinking themselves. They were, and for their reasons they could give. I don't know if any of them were big enough to actually recommend someone else. No, I think Peter should be. Did someone say that? I don't know. That would be...
Peter, my dad.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, right. That would have been a start if someone would have, again, recommended a fellow disciple. But that's not what we actually heard from it. And like Steve actually brought up, here are two of them that have the boldness to consider they are first and second of all the disciples, and therefore they should be able to sit on the right and the left hand of Jesus in His coming kingdom.
Jim,
yes.
One illustration. I mean, different people have different kinds of parents, but you know, my dad and my mom were very loving parents, and on numerous occasions they sacrificed themselves for their children. Now, that didn't mean that the children then ran the family.
Good.
But it did mean that the parents were not running it for themselves. They were running it for the good of the whole family, especially for their children. And it's just like Jesus. He wasn't going to let the apostles then take over. Now you can preach instead of Jesus.
Sure.
But He was doing everything for them, as He demonstrated when He washed their feet.
All right. So in the home, a good illustration. Parents doing for the children's need and not just their own adult preferences, as it were. What else would anyone add about what this looks like in practice when you regard others as more important than self? I'd asked that question a couple back. What does this look like in practice? And we can ask it even at this point also. Or what would you add to this discussion we've been saying when you regard one another as more important? Well, let's finish a couple of other passages. So we've considered the disciples. Wrong example. They weren't anywhere close to this view of each other. But they will learn from Jesus. They'll learn from Jesus who laid down His own life for not only the disciples, but all men. And they'll realize, I'm to be like that. That's how I'm to view others. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. You know, we talked about weaker members earlier. I talked about newborn sheep, you know, coming into the flock. And Paul's going to talk about that very kind of situation in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 20. Garrett, would you read, please, verses 20 through 26?
But now, there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body, which seem to be weaker, are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor, and our less presentable members become much more presentable. Whereas our more presentable members have no need of it, but God has so composed the body, that member which lacked, so that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it.
Okay, thank you. You know, you're reading through that, and you no doubt you're thinking of both the physical body and the spiritual body. In fact, it started out talking about the physical body. And my leaning is, that's mainly what he's talking about. And then he finally says in verse 26, or rather 27, now you are Christ's body, and individually members of it. Oh, so now you make you draw the parallels. But it sure sounds like that whole reading is the physical body, and that's how God so composed verse 27. It's how he designed the body. I know we're used to reading members and thinking church members. But the word means body parts, means organs. And that's how God designed it. Well, my point is not to argue actually which. These statements apply to both. But for example, these less honorable or less seemly, one translation puts it, we bestow more abundant honor. Most folks believe that that's a reference to clothing ourselves. But we don't clothe every bit of us. We let our face show, we let our hands show, things like that. But our less seemly members or less honorable, we bestow more abundant honor on that with our clothing, whereas our seemly members have no need of it. That's just an application talking about the physical body itself. What else did he say besides the honorable and less honorable? Where did he mention, did he not mention weaker? Yes, thank you. It is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. Again, he's starting with talking about the physical body. Tell me a weaker member of the physical body. Laura. Yeah, that's what I was going for. She said the spleen. You know what that's based on? It's often injured, you know, very, very easily. I think if you get hit in the back, lower back, kind of to a side. You know, you can not even break a bone and you've burst your spleen on the inside. We should talk to Brother John Manette. He's the local expert on internal anatomy and maybe injury to it. So you can back this up, right? The spleen can be weak. And vulnerable is an idea. Actually, we don't have to go into that. I'm sorry. I'm not sure. I'll tell you another very weak member, your eyeball. You can barely touch it with your own finger. You know, and you go, oh, that's weak. But what do we think about? What do we think about that weak member? Yes. What? Yes. And you protect it at all costs. Transfer that to members of a local church that are weaker in some way, and yet we're to view them as so important that we're going to protect them. You know, come to their aid, come to their rescue, make sure they don't fall away just because they're weaker, or don't drift away, or again, the devil just discourages. You can make sure that doesn't happen. Oh, don't do that just because they're weaker. So, those members which seem weaker are necessary, you know, Paul will say. Okay, so there's some of the application. We're going to have to sum up there, so we have a little time just to finish up our gathering tonight. I appreciate everyone's interest and participation in it. Next time we'll talk about Jesus as this supreme example that Paul urged them to imitate.